Diagramming difficult things to think about. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, very good friend, and the guy that keeps everything running around here, Chuck Michaels.
Or at least I do my best to do that. I'm the guy who's messed us up last week. We got to the day that we were supposed to record, and I had not been feeling well, and I went to the doctor that morning, and it turned out I had some kind of infection. So I had no voice. Basically, I felt like I'd been run over by a dump truck. And so I said, yeah, I think we're going to run a rerun this week.
So in other words, we wanted to have a quality program, and I also didn't want to catch something. So we decided not to sit here in the studio together while he was sick.
So you got a rerun that actually kind of fits in with what we're going to talk about today, because we did a rerun on the shenanigans inside the Republican Party. And what do you know? Big surprise in an election year, especially an election year with as much as is at stake this year, and as much as the old guard Republicans are fighting tooth and toenail to hold on to their positions, that it looks like a lot of them might lose.
Well, it's a possibility, yes.
Yes.
Well, you know, Chuck, it's, as they say, what goes around comes around. Well, usually, you know, even though we said it was an oldie but a goodie in a rerun, some things really never change, and it goes around and it comes back around again, and that's true, really, with politics, because it seems like some people don't ever want to change how they do things, and some people never learn when something happens and they should know better. And we're going to be talking a lot about that today, because over the last couple of weeks, there have been a number of high profile and some not so high profile activities that have been going on politically that we want to try to diagram out and help our listeners understand how these things fit together in some ways, and what the picture actually shows as we're moving forward in this 2014 election cycle. And the first thing I want to just briefly chat about was that the Republican Governors Association, yes, that venerated organization of staunch conservatives. I knew you were going to do that.
Pardon me while I burst out laughing. You mean like John Kasich?
Well, I mean like a number of people. But they had, over the last couple of weeks, their meeting. During their meeting of the National Governors Association, which happened over this last weekend, they had a few things on their agenda, and we're going to talk about a couple of them today because they really do play a significant role in how issues are going to be dealt with during this election cycle and in the future. And I also think it points out our viewpoint here that what goes around comes around and some people never learn. First thing I want to talk about is the fact that the Republican Governors Association had a meeting, and they decided that they were going to, on their formal agenda, talk about a little situation called Common Core Education Standards.
Oh, boy.
Okay, well, you know, basically their idea is, well, we need standards, but these standards have become, and in the words of Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, radioactive, so we really need to just change the marketing. You notice they're not talking about getting rid of Common Core. They're talking about, let's name it something else.
Let's call it something else.
Let's call it something else.
Well, and Indiana did that. Mike Pence, thank you, the big conservative, quote-unquote, who's governor of Indiana, signed a bill that were the supposedly repudiating Common Core, and they basically took Common Core and named it something else.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's their whole point, is because, as our listeners are probably fairly well aware, especially here in Ohio, the idea of a federally designed education rubric or federal standards called Common Core has rankled many in the education community, especially parents who believe in the idea of liberty and local control, but also teachers. I believe that the American Federation of Teachers just had their big meeting where they came out and soundly thrashed Common Core as being anti-teacher as much as anti-learning. Because that's really what it is, Chuck. It's anti-learning. So in Ohio, we've had, unfortunately, we were one of the states who drank the federal Kool-Aid and got involved with No Child Left Behind a few years ago when the Bush administration put it out, thinking it was the next great thing in education. You know, every president that comes in wants to be the education president, and that means that education just keeps getting worse and worse because most of them don't know what they're doing, and they pass these huge bills that either the teachers' unions or other groups who want to control and federalize everything put forward. And so we end up with getting farther and farther away from actually true education, and that's really what Common Core is. You know, we're now talking about doing math in a way where, oh, well, we're going to consider this equation here. So, you know, 147 minus 53. Well, let's figure it out by saying, well, okay, well, what number plus 4 will equal 3, you know, or 13? And how do we do that? Okay, Charles, is that how you learn subtraction?
That's not how I learned subtraction.
No, but that's part of, yeah, that's one of the Common Core examples. Now, somebody say, oh, well, that's just, dude, we're talking about standards here. We're not talking about curriculum. Yes, you are. Stop being duplicitous. Standards drive curriculum as much as the standards shape the assessments at the end. The high-stakes tests that are being developed off the standards drive the curriculum. And so teaching to the test, well, Common Core just assures that your students will learn nothing else but
what's on the test
because there are so many high stakes. And now the stakes are doubled because the folks at the federal level got smart. Instead of dilly-dallying with the state governors or the state legislatures to get this done and then having them, you know, back out of it, they handed the money because we got into No Child Left Behind. We couldn't meet the threshold, the benchmarks for getting schools up to a certain level because they were set way too high to start with. Then that put us into default. But the only way we could get out of it, we could get a waiver if we signed up for what's called Race to the Top funding. Now, Race to the Top funding, the state had to agree that it would implement Common Core standards in order to get the funding. Now, Race to the Top money did not come to the states. It came directly to local school districts who were picked to be part of the, you know, cream of the crop in Race to the Top. Well, they just directed federal money right to the local districts so that if the state now, since they've signed this agreement, has found that it is basically radioactive, as Governor Branstad of Iowa said about the Common Core, then in order for them to get out of it, they are now looking at defaulting the local school districts who, if they do not fully implement Common Core as part of the agreement of taking the money, they have to pay back all the money to the federal government. The local districts do. Well, considering the fact that the state didn't have money to start with, and that's the reason why they got into this mess, is to get federal money, now they're going to be, well, we get rid of Common Core, then all the local districts are going to have to, we're going to have to indemnify them somehow and hold them harmless, so we're going to have to come up with all this money to pay the feds back to protect these local school districts.
No, you don't.
You don't. But I'm just saying that's what they're thinking.
Yes.
Okay, Chuck. That's the reason why Governor Kasich and a number of legislative leaders, the House Education Committee chairman, the Senate Education Committee chairman are all moaning and groaning about how these people are just being, you know, worrywarts and worse. And, of course, you know, there have been some people using some very, shall we say, unfortunately inappropriate ways of expressing themselves when talking about parents who are concerned about what their children are learning.
Yeah.
Including the House Education Committee chairman, who I think lives in the district this program airs in, so I hope he hears it.
Yes.
but
you want to mention a name?
Jerry Stubbleton. I have no fear of mentioning his name.
No, Jerry Stubbleton has basically come out and said some really nasty things about, and basically saying that we're stupid if we oppose Common Core.
Well, exactly. That Common Core is the best thing he's seen in education, blah, 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 blah. And anybody who just opposes it, we've got our heads stuck in the mud or something to that effect.
And the reason he's doing it is because?
The governor wants it.
The governor wants it, and what's the governor running for?
Re-election.
And what else?
Well, for president in 2 years.
Yeah. Exactly.
And the House Education Committee chairman's on his way out the door because of term limits. And it's interesting. He'd be done in the legislature right about the same time the governor would take his seat for his second term and start making cabinet appointments.
Yeah.
Because all we, as we've seen in the past with Bob Taft and with other governors who've had more than one term, usually in the second term you get people who were heads of departments leaving to go do something else, knowing that they're on short window anyway, and new people being appointed to fill these positions. Of course, there are a number of positions that are interim positions right now anyway.
Yeah.
Directors of departments and agencies. Who knows? Maybe, and I'm not going to make any claims, but, you know, that could be in somebody's thinking process.
Well, let's just say that no deals have probably been cut at this early date, but everybody knows who's dealing the cards.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. But so the national governors, which is both the Republicans and the Democrats, but it's mainly the Republicans who are talking right now because they're the ones who are starting to feel the heat on this issue, is, you know, they're like, well, we don't want people outside our state telling us what our standards should be, while at the same time, they're signing the agreements to put Common Core in place.
Yeah, basically, Common Core is a creation of the National Governors Association.
Yeah, they were part of the ones who supposedly were the genesis of it, but really...
Right.
You had third-party groups who came to the NGA and told them how wonderful it would be right. If we all aligned our standards and how they could be leaders and they would be seen as hailed as the saviors of education if they just pushed this thing. Well, now, the funny thing is, Common Core, you know, when Branstad said it was radioactive and we should just rename it, well, that's okay, Terry. We have renamed it because this used to be called Goals 2000,
yes.
Outcomes 2000, School to Work.
It's already, how many name changes do you get?
But it's all the same stuff.
It's all exactly the same stuff.
It's now, just they got smart with the funding mechanism. That's the only reason why they're being successful right now.
This is another perfect example of how basically a bunch of governors who wanted political advantage saw a way and got led down the primrose path by quote-unquote experts. Unfortunately, folks, we live in an era when we want to have experts run everything.
Right.
Well, the experts basically, apparently, don't know their hat from third base. Because, to be quite honest, the complete non-experts already know how to educate their children. And basically, they're home educators.
Yeah, exactly.
And the fact is that home educators, now I don't want to paint with too broad a brush because there are people who miseducate their people at their kids at home at least as badly as they get miseducated in a public school. But the fact is that a broad range of home educators are looking for the opportunity to not just teach their kids to a specific test or curriculum,
right.
But to teach them how to think on their own in a broad sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not what you get with Common Core, because the last thing educrats want is for people thinking on their own.
On their own. That's exactly what they don't want. They look, you can call it paranoid. You can say that we're Pollyannas. Whatever you want to say, the fact is that the purpose of education, of public education, is not to teach children how to think, it's to teach children what to think. And one of the things they're supposed to think is that people in positions of quote-unquote authority are really their superiors. When instead of having kids who know how to think, who think that those same people are their servants. And that is something that, A, the National Governors Association would much rather deal with people who think that they're superior than have to deal with people who think that they're their servants.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's not kid ourselves.
You know, that's true. But that's not the only thing
No.
that the National Governors Association had on tap during their three-day meeting, because they also decided to have a little discussion about same-sex marriage. Now, Chuck, three guesses as to how that discussion went. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is coming from the Republican governors. So we're not talking about the Democrat governors here.
It's the RGA.
This is the Republican Governors Association.
Right, instead of the NGA.
That's right. And it seems that after the Republican governors, and again, Republicans hold more state houses or more governor's offices than the Democrats do. I think it's like 22 to 18 or 23 to 17 or something like that. But in other words, we hold a number. The Republicans
hold
the majority.
Those numbers don't add up to 50.
But, excuse me. I'm sorry. I was
now,
getting
see,
backwards.
Public education at work, folks.
I meant 33-17.
There you go.
Excuse
yeah, it's pretty lopsided right now.
It is something of that nature. But anyhow, so they get into their meetings and they come out, and it seems that what they really are doing is trying to soften their supposed position on same-sex marriage. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin that many conservatives are enamored about, was quoted this way. He says, "I don't think the Republican Party is fighting it." And I'm not saying it's not important, Walker said, but Republicans haven't been talking about it. We've been talking about economic and fiscal issues. It's those on the left that are pushing it. In other words, if we ignore it, it'll just go away. It seems to be Scott Walker's position.
Despite the fact that it, is the party fighting it? It doesn't look that way, even though it's in the platform.
Oh, well, see, now you've just touched on a raw nerve, my friend, because I'm not sure about Wisconsin, but I know in Ohio, Governor John Kasich has nothing to worry about regarding the platform, because the Ohio Republican Party refuses to adopt the platform.
Well, Barry, do you remember the shocked look on people's faces, including people who were on Central Committee?
Who didn't realize that
when we brought that fact up at one, I think one of our Constitution classes.
Yes.
We chatted about that, and the fact is that the Ohio Republican Party has sidestepped the issue by simply refusing to implement the national platform.
Yeah, exactly. Now, some other states, and Walker among them, they are actually the their state is filing suit to protect their marriage amendment in that state. But other governors like Chris Christie and others who have said that, no, you know what, this really isn't our fight. Chris Christie basically decided not to appeal a ruling and allowed homosexual, quote-unquote, marriages or ceremonies to take place in New Jersey. Terry Branstad, who we just talked about a minute ago, you know, his idea now, Chuck, this sounds like the "I want to be called a pro-lifer, but you know, listen to what I say" kind of speech. This is Branstad on same-sex marriage. Quote, "That is a very controversial and divisive issue. I'm a religious conservative. I'm a Catholic. I'm pro-life. But I think the people of Iowa look to me to provide leadership and bring in good jobs and growing the Iowa economy." In other words, I'm personally
opposed.
He didn't even say he was opposed to it. He walked all the way around that. I'm religious conservative. I'm Catholic. Blah blah blah. I'm pro-life. That doesn't tell me where you are on marriage issue. Then you tell me, well, the people of Iowa want me to focus on jobs and the economy. That tells me where you are.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and they're concerned because there's some polling that have come out, and we all know how polls run because polls can say anything the pollsters or the people who are paying for the poll want it to come out to
depends
say.
How you ask the question.
It depends on how you ask the question.
And who you ask the question of.
But supposedly a recent Gallup poll showed 55% support now for homosexual marriage. However, we know, especially here in Ohio, when you keep polling on that, we're still sitting at pretty much the same numbers we had since 2004 when the marriage amendment was passed by 63-37.
And Nebraska, right. I think, had something very similar just a few years ago. I wouldn't swear to that, and I don't have it in front of me. But I think they passed one, too, by similar numbers.
Yeah, it was very similar.
Now, there's a magic word in the title of that poll.
Yes.
Gallup.
Gallup, that's right.
Gallup is infamous for running push polls.
Yes, they are.
Gallup is not a reliable polling agency, and so therefore, if you're going to build an entire social method of dealing with the social planks in your platform on a bad poll, then you're going to get what you deserve.
Right. Now, you know, we just talked a minute ago about the Republican National Platform. Now, you got to remember, platforms are things that are great to put up on a shelf to look at, new and odd, but they really don't have much use if you don't use them as a tool.
Yeah.
Well, because after the 2012 elections, the Republican National Committee, the RNC, who is the national party, commissioned a report which called for, quote, more inclusive and welcoming tones on divisive social issues, particularly those including the treatment and the rights of gays. In other words, we are ready to surrender and give in to the zeitgeist of the culture.
Well, let's get something out of the way that we need to talk about, and people don't really seem to grasp very well. That is that there is no right to homosexual activity.
No, there's not.
There's also no right to sex outside of marriage. There's no right to adultery. There's no right to any of these things, because we know for a fact where our rights come from. We acknowledge that in the Declaration of Independence, and that is that our rights come from God.
Yes.
And at no point did God ever give us the right to engage in those activities. In fact, he directly forbade them. So this idea that homosexuals have the right to engage in this activity, and they have the right to marry, and they have this right and that right, what they have a right to do is live their lives and obey God and do the right things. And what they don't have the right to do is do things that God has directly forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not a very popular thing to say. And I'm gathering that wouldn't take a Gallup poll to come up with a vast majority of people who think that doing whatever they want to do in the privacy of their own homes or bedrooms is their right.
Well, that sounds like a truly libertarian
model. It's a libertarian viewpoint. It's not a Christian libertarian viewpoint, because I think you and I would both describe ourselves as Christian libertarians.
Yes.
We believe in liberty up to and including all the things that God has given us the liberty to do.
Mm-hmm.
That does not include all the things that God has forbidden for us to do.
Right. Exactly. But that's not the way the culture's going. The culture is,
right,
if it feels good, do it. You know, they've been weaned on Nike commercials and fast food commercials that says, "Hey, have it your way and just do it." And but so the reason why this is coming up in the Republican Governors Association is because right now across the country there are challenges to states who have put in place traditional marriage amendments in their constitution, Ohio being one of them. Now, it's interesting, Chuck, because Ohio, Tennessee, Michigan, and Kentucky all have had same-sex marriage bans or traditional marriage constitutional amendments in their constitutions. All four states have been challenged. And in a number of states, including Ohio, you've had district court judges who have said, "Oh, it's unconstitutional to have that in your constitution." Huh, funny. When is it unconstitutional for a state to self-determine how they're going to deal with certain relationships?
Well, this is where the courts and the federal government get schizophrenic.
Yes, they do.
Basically, you have the right to self-determination except when we tell you that you don't.
Exactly. And we'll tell you that you don't when you go against the prevailing winds of the culture.
Yeah, and that's it. And in fact, the voice of the people should reign supreme except when it says that you can't, like in California, that which passed a gay marriage ban by something like 65%.
Right.
Well, Prop 8.
Yes.
Well, you can't do that.
Yes, well, the people don't have that right.
People don't have the right, the right of the people. Now, I would agree. Let's say that the people voted to, let's just pick a racial group, Eskimos. That you have the right to discriminate against Eskimos and to steal their property and to kill them and to do any kinds of, think of something bad. And
I don't want to.
Eskimos are on that list, that they can be discriminated against at will. Is that something that a state can do?
Well, no, of course not.
Of course not. That's not what we're saying, and that's not the case here.
No, it's not.
And that's where we run into trouble, that somehow we're equating racial characteristics, and race is an artificial dividing line.
Ethnic characteristics.
Ethnic dividing lines.
Right.
Again, an artificial set of characteristics.
again, conflating it with behaviors.
And conflating it with behaviors. Now,
so in other words, after this is all over with, kleptomaniacs and others who have, you know, an irresistible urge to take other people's stuff should be given rights and protections because, well, it's a behavior, but it's how they identify themselves.
Okay, but let's just stick with sexual behaviors. Just
sure. Well, yeah, then we can open the Pandora's box, and it's already
And the
been
Pandora's
open.
Box is open because we're already seeing the courts beginning to issue rulings. There was a ruling last week, I believe, that basically said that laws against incest are probably unconstitutional.
Well, that was a justice in Australia. That wasn't an American judge. But it also begs into the idea that what happens if we have another country who legalizes those forms of relationships, and because we believe international law and we need to be a part of a world community, that we say that, well, in order for us to have a treaty with that country, well, we have to, by treaty, we'll adopt those standards.
It goes beyond that because we have Supreme Court justices who are going to international law.
Yes, for American cases.
Consortiums and meetings and basically pledging to include laws from other nations.
Yes.
Into their decisions.
And have done so since about 2000 because Lawrence versus Texas,
yes.
One of the strong bases of the case was an argument out of an Irish court that gave us the legalization of sodomy in the country. Well, I say legalization because that's the term most people know it as. But it's not legal to do something that's against God's law.
That's right.
So the normalization of it,
yeah.
Because that's all the courts are really doing now, because they can't determine, and this is something that's bugged me for a long time, Chuck. Nine people sitting in black robes do not make law in this country any more than you and I make law in this country. All they can do is interpret the laws that are made by the duly appointed branch of government, which is the Congress, because they're the only lawmaking body in this country, as to whether or not the laws that are made comport with the Constitution. But these nine people in black robes have changed it around and decided, no, we're going to see if the Constitution comports with how things are now, the zeitgeist of the culture, whether or not polling indicates that this is where people want to go, and whether or not we like what the Congress did or didn't do. You know, now the vast majority, and the Roberts Court is bad about this just as much as any other court's been in the last 40 years, of basically saying that something, they'll say it's constitutional or unconstitutional, but then they'll make up just whole cloth these constitutional rules.
Well, let's talk about historically what the view of where law came from.
Sure.
At the beginning of the Republic, and what the Constitution is based upon, is the idea that legislatures do not actually make law.
They discover law that's already there.
And codify it. And if you and if you don't believe that, all you have to do is read legal thinkers like, and one of the main legal thinkers of the Revolutionary era, and that was a guy named James Otis. And James Otis wrote a piece where basically he said a legislature cannot make 2 and 2 = 5. Now, what was he saying? That's a very short section of the quote. It's a very long and a very informative quote. And basically what he says is when legislatures discover that they have not made law according to existing law, and that is God's law, because that was Otis's point.
Right, God's law and the common law. Yes.
God's law and the common law were the only law that actually existed. And he says when legislatures find out that they have made this mistake and made a law that wasn't a law, then their job is to repeal that law.
Undo it, yes.
Undo it, because it's already actually undone. And in fact, anybody who violates such a law is actually obeying the law. Now,
right, exactly. And there's a quote that I'm going to be, we're recording this midweek, I'm going to be teaching a little mini IOTC class tonight to a group down in Circleville, and I'm going to be using a quote from one of our founders that basically said that a legislature cannot protect us. You know, a legislature cannot pass laws to counter God's law, nor can they protect us from his wrath if they pass something that we follow that is goes against his law.
Right. And so it's a very important consideration to realize that whether we like it or not, and despite the things we'd really love to, you know, we'd love to live in a society where we can just decide what, as a people, what we want to do. That only works if the people, there's a popular kind of idea out there that vox populi, vox dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. And I, to that I would say, not necessarily. Was the voice of the people in Germany the voice of God?
No.
Especially since the voice of the people in Germany had been manipulated by, well, forces within the government who grabbed control of the education system.
Yes.
And spent 12 years poisoning children's minds. And in effect, while the parents retained custody of their children, the government was very clear that who owned the children was the state.
Yes.
And we are not Sadly. Using such explicit language now, but it is the bottom line outcome of what we're seeing with some of the stuff here.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, going back here, because we're talking about making law or not law, these district court judges have overturned the vote of the people in these four states. Now, they're stayed because they're on appeal. Now, what's happened is those four states, Tennessee, Michigan, Kentucky, and Ohio, are all in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals district. All four states' cases have been consolidated into one hearing that's going to happen on August the 6th. Now, it's interesting because you got the Republican Governors Association backpedaling and acting like they're going to get all squishy in the middle on same-sex marriage. And here in Ohio, you've got the Attorney General Mike DeWine, who, you know, for interest of full disclosure, is running for re-election. But whether or not
isn't all that popular.
Well, that's okay, one way or the other. But his office has filed a brief in this case that's going to be heard on the 6th of August, defending the state's, as the reporter calls it, ban on same-sex marriage. No, it's our state constitutional amendment to uphold traditional marriage is what that language is. I know. I worked on it. I was part of the team that put it together and got it on the ballot. So I hate it when they start talking about our ban on same-sex marriage, because you can't ban something that is already impermissible by God's law.
That's right.
I mean, it's just you're discovering it. You're not making it up.
And it's been banned since the beginning of time.
Indeed. So, you know, basically they're asking for the appeals court to overturn the ruling of here in Ohio. It was Federal Judge Timothy Black in Cincinnati who came up with this specious reasoning that somehow the people of the state of Ohio in passing the marriage amendment weren't acting charitable or loving or even in the and they didn't even act with sense, Chuck. It was a mad world that passed that.
We're a bunch of meanies.
Now, part of the defense that the AG DeWine's office is putting up is that, and this is a quote from the brief, that courts should not presume that voters are not capable of deciding an issue of this sensitivity on decent and rational grounds. Now, do you get that? I don't really, never had a warm spot for Mike DeWine, but it's getting more and more cold the more
I read say, this is
how he's trying to quote-unquote defend this, because what he's really arguing is, oh, if you go the other way on this, you're saying that not only are the voters not decent, but they're not rational when it comes to homosexual pairings trying to get recognition of something that God's only reserved to man and woman. You're not being rational and you're not being decent, which means you're full of hate and you are somehow mentally ill. Now, I say that because we understand that's the direction that the culture is going.
Right.
And folks, today is a day of drawing some diagrams to help you put some pieces together. You have to understand that words have meaning still. Even though we supposedly live in a postmodern culture, there's still some firmness and finality to words. It's just that they're being used in different ways now to hide what the thrust of the issue really is. You know, so Black is basically saying that, you know, people in Ohio are hateful, and really the voters who support traditional marriage, there's something wrong with them.
Yes.
There's something wrong with them. And DeWine's office is, you know, trying to defend the state's position on this, and saying that, well, you know, that the folks who filed suit against Ohio's law or their constitutional amendment, quote, share an expansive view of the judiciary's role to reshape society, unquote, and, oh, excuse me, and continue the quote, and an equally expansive view of the court's prerogatives to do so in the face of contrary Supreme Court precedent. Now, that loses on two counts for me.
Yeah.
The first count is you're making an argument to the Court of Appeals that, oh, we don't think that the judiciary should have an expansive role. Now, this is a judiciary has been expanding for the last 50 years of their rulings in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. They're not a conservative court, Chuck. I mean,
no.
They're not as liberal as, say, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out in California that everybody knows about, that's the far left.
The Ninth Circus.
Ninth Circus. Well, the Sixth Circus is almost as liberal. It's just that they don't have as many juicy issues to deal with.
Right.
But to make this argument that, well, you know, the plaintiffs in this case are wrong because they have this view, this view of an expansive view of the judiciary's role to reshape society. Sorry, A.G. DeWine. The justices have that view. When they get up there and they put on black robes, they believe that they are the guiders of society.
I'm seeing other weaknesses here.
Oh, there are many. I said there was two. That was just one of them.
Yeah, the plaintiffs, here's a quote. The plaintiffs cannot create a specific right to same-sex marriage merely by alleging that they seek to participate in the general right to marry. What? I'll be quite honest. That's an argument?
Now, well, yeah, and you guys said that with a question mark in your voice. You're right. That's my problem with DeWine's brief here. It sounds to me like he's trying to make the weakest argument he possibly can.
Yes.
So that the courts will just ignore it.
Yes. This is damnation by faint praise.
Exactly.
It's exactly
this is for him to go parade around that he's defending marriage.
He's defending marriage
when he's doing the least amount possible that he has to by the responsibility of his office to do.
Well, there is no general right to marry, and the reason we know that, go and try and get a marriage license between you and your sister.
Right, can't happen. Well,
nope. Yet. Now. As we spoke of earlier.
And I'm an only child, so I can say that.
As we spoke about earlier, now you say that's an Australian case. I'm going to have to look that back up because I was pretty sure that that. But
no, I actually read it. They had a picture of the guy with the powdered wig and the whole shtick.
But in any case, coming to a courtroom near you, don't kid yourself. If it's happening there, it'll happen here. It's sort of like as California goes, so goes the world. Well, as Europe, Asia, Australia, and Africa go the United States.
Now, the second issue I have with this portion of the brief that DeWine is so proud of is this whole idea that, you know, that, oh, it's the problem with the, you know, the decision by Black is that, you know, the plaintiffs, the four same-sex couples who filed lawsuit, have an equally expansive view of the court's prerogatives to do so, i.e., reshape society in the face of contrary Supreme Court precedent. Number one, first of all, which contrary Supreme Court precedent is he really looking at? Because if I remember correctly, they ruled the wrong way on Prop 8.
Yeah, they did.
So I'm not sure which, because the Supreme Court precedent that seems to be the most germane to this particular discussion is that case right there, and that is not against these plaintiffs. It's going the other direction and making the case that, hey, the voters aren't acting rationally or, how was it? They're not acting in a rational or decent grounds in passing this amendment.
Well, you know, this goes to the issue. This is basically the federalization of marriage. Now, you and I talked about this years ago. We were talking about this when you were working for an organization down out of Cincinnati,
right?
That was heavily involved in getting the marriage amendment passed in Ohio. They were also have been working on the federal marriage amendment, the federal marriage. And I said, no, bad plan.
Well, and you, if you remember, I was also I was also working on your side on that one.
Yes, you were. thank goodness for that. And I remember we got excoriated for that because you did, from someone who we knew who you work for that group, and therefore you're all with them, and therefore you're pro-UN. And this went off into some wild tangent. But in any case, I said, no, the minute you pass that amendment, you have federalized the regulation of marriage, which has always been in the hands of states. And I know people who say that the state has no business regulating marriage. And to that I say, there are certain prohibitions that must be made. They don't like the idea that states license marriage. And I said, the reason they license marriage, the whole reason that they license marriage was, A, to record them, was the main reason when it first started, so that there was a record of a marriage for any number of reasons, for heirs and all kinds of things. But second of all, it was protection from disease.
Yes.
As things went along. So you basically, that's why you had to have a blood test so you could get a marriage license.
Yep.
To make sure that you did not carry a number of syphilitic or venereal type diseases that would not only, would eventually kill both parties and any offspring, or at least severely damage the offspring. The third reason was to keep you from marrying your first cousin, which is A, forbidden biblically, and B, is partially forbidden because it creates all kinds of genetic issues. So I've never had a problem with the state setting certain regulatory bounds on who can get married and who can't. Otherwise, you end up with chaos. Of course, now we have chaos.
Well,
because people don't get married.
Well, we have interesting forms of chaos now.
Then we have different forms of chaos.
Because, I may give DeWine's office credit. Maybe one of the court precedents that he's talking about is the Hobby Lobby decision, which basically said that an employer has a religious right not to provide abortifacient drug coverage in their insurance plans for employees, which was roundly dissed by most liberals. Yes. And most in the Planned Parenthood community, but also has now become the rationale for gay rights groups to withdraw their support of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act.
And,
because in order to try to sell it to the public and to lawmakers, they put in provisions that said if you're a religious organization, you could still, quote-unquote, discriminate in hiring. Now they're afraid with the Hobby Lobby decision that would extend to religious-based hospitals and religious, on and on.
Yep.
In other words, what they're saying is, well, wait a minute, we weren't really wanting to give anybody an exemption for anything, and we want to force the gay agenda on you. But now that you trumped this here, all of a sudden, a bill that they had, and they admit, gay rights advocates admit, they've been working on this bill for 20 years. They thought they were right there because the president was supporting it. They were pushing the issue.
Yep.
They've been trying to push it in the states. As a matter of fact, it was introduced in the state House and Senate in Ohio this last year again, and by Republicans and Democrats, one Republican and a bunch of Democrats in both chambers. But now they understand that what they were trying to do to pull the wool over conservatives and the rest of the public's eyes by saying, why should you be opposed to this if you're religious? You have an exemption. Now they're saying, well, wait a minute, the environment's changed. That exemption means that you can actually do something.
Yes,
we can't have that anymore, so we're backing off. And so the ACLU, let me see, how many groups? The ACLU, Lambda Legal, National Center for Lesbian Rights, have all pulled their support from the federal into legislation. In other words, the bill has totally crashed on its face. Just when they thought the Huns were about ready to come across the gates.
Yeah, they were on the cusp of passing it and getting it and pushing it through. And basically, what the Supreme Court says, the religious exemption has teeth.
Yes.
Now, there are major issues with that whole religious exemption thing and blah blah and but if you'll recall, you and I have been talking about this forever. This was okay. I'm going to talk about just for a second. Sure. Hegelian dialectic.
Yes.
In Leninism terms, it was termed as two steps forward, one step back. Okay, the Obamacare, the whole original Obamacare decision was two steps forward. This is one step back.
Yes.
Now, what's the net gain for those who wanted more government control of your health care? One step. They have taken one step in the right direction. There's one step now back. Now, what's interesting, Barry, is that Democrats are talking about a way to, they're all issuing bills to negate this Supreme Court decision.
Right. And you know, Chuck, I don't have a real big problem with the fact that they're putting bills out there because, well, that really is constitutionally one of the things that Congress can do.
Exactly. This is one of those things that when we bring this up and we say there are places where Congress can rein in the courts.
This is one of them.
And this is one of them, even though it doesn't go in the direction that I would like to see.
Right.
The fact is,
it's not going to go anywhere.
But these same people were telling us we were crazy.
Right.
When we were saying this.
Right.
And now all of a sudden, we're not so crazy.
It's like, oh, I guess they might have known what they were talking about there.
And what we're talking about, I think anybody who's interested should sign up for one of our Institute on the Constitution courses. And when we get to Article 3, we talk about this.
Yes.
How where the courts have original jurisdiction and where they have appellate jurisdiction, and the fact that Congress has the power to restrict their appellate jurisdiction.
Yes, they do.
And this was an appellate case.
Yeah, well, it was an appellate case for the courts, and it should have been because of the way it was brought up.
Right.
Unlike some other cases that they've had when they should have taken original jurisdiction.
Exactly. When the states filed suit, the first thing that should have been done was, and here's what the Supreme Court said, we're not taking that case as an original jurisdiction case. The Constitution says
you have to.
They had no choice, and they said they weren't going to. Well, what should have happened was that the state should have said, you're taking it, period.
Right.
We're one of the plaintiffs, and therefore you can't walk away from it. But what they said, it has to go through the appellate
process.
But
that goes right back to that whole brief by Mike DeWine's office.
Yes.
That basically says, well, the plaintiffs are wrong because, oh, it flies in the face of previous Supreme Court decisions. It's like, wait a minute. Supreme Court precedent is not your last arbiter of what's legal and what's not legal. Or what's constitutional, what's not constitutional. Because that has never been this court's job. The court's job is to decide matters of conflict between parties using the Constitution, and then it's determining whether the law and the facts lead to the right decision.
Right, right. And therein lies the rub. Here, basically, everybody's saying, well, let's make new law. Let's make the courts get the courts to make new law. When U.S. District Judge Timothy Black basically said that the Ohio law was null and void, and all you know, which basically ended up applying to everybody in the circuit.
Yes.
Which is a weird way to look at, you know, because that leaves other circuits out, which is really, really strange.
Well, that's part of our federal overlay on top of the states, which is one of the failings of the misinterpretation of the Constitution.
Exactly, exactly. But what that did was he basically said our ruling, and you know, he issued the ruling, but the only way for these, a single judge doesn't issue a ruling in an appellate case.
Right.
It's a vote.
Right. Well, remember, it was a district judge to start with. The appellate courts are going to be hearing it.
That's right. So. You're right. He's a district court judge.
Yes.
But the fact is, he created new law. He basically said federal law says that state law doesn't hold in this case. Now, cite the federal law. The only federal law, Well, here's I'll guarantee you, I have not read the decision. It's going to contain the 14th Amendment.
Oh, I'm sure that will.
That you can't escape that. Now, the 14th Amendment says nothing about any of this. And nor does it imply it. to be fair to the 14th Amendment. However, it has been stretched. The meaning of the 14th Amendment has been stretched out of all proportion.
Yes.
In order to make it cover cases like this. And in order to usurp authority that belongs to the states, in order to put the federal government in the driver's seat on these kinds of cases, when in fact they were never supposed to have this jurisdiction to start with.
That's right.
The Article 1, Section 8 and 9 contain all the enumerated powers and the limitations on the states. And guess what, folks? Marriage, health care, welfare. Yes, the general welfare clause is in there, but it's the general welfare of the state governments, not of individual people.
Indeed.
Now, none of those are contained in the United States Constitution in the enumerated powers, and therefore the federal government has no jurisdiction over them. Now, if you don't like what's going on in your home state, you were never supposed to be able to go to the federal government and said, make them do that here, make them do it here, make them do it here, make them do it here. If you didn't like it, you worked inside your state to change the existing state law, or you voted with your feet and left.
Right.
And a lot of people did that.
Yep.
Now all of a sudden it's like, well, it's my right to do that. No such right.
No.
There's no such right as the right for gay marriage. There's no such right for all the things that we've mentioned in the past. And incest, there is no right to that. There is no pedophilia right, although that is also on the radar. And we now have the same people who were the same, not exactly the same individuals, but when I say the same people, the same groups, the psychology, quote-unquote, experts, the psychiatric, quote-unquote, experts, the relationship, quote-unquote, experts are saying that, well, maybe perhaps we need to relook at these adult-children relationships because very often it can be, quote-unquote, healthy for them. No, it can't. And this is the way homosexuality became accepted. The quote-unquote experts came out and said, well, it's perfectly normal. It's something that has gone on in society. Yeah, of course it's gone on in society. All kinds of sin goes on in society.
That's right.
You can't walk away from sin in a society because man is sinful. That's what laws are for.
That's exactly right. But, you know, that's where we have to understand that law out of context, and that's the context of God's law, isn't law at all. It's a perversion. And that's the reason why we're sitting here arguing over whether or not, oh, is it okay for two men engaging in sexual activity together to put on tuxes and a wedding ring and have a cake and everybody go ooh and ah, and we consider that on a par with biblical marriage? You know, we've lost the concept of what true law is because we've become laws unto ourselves. And, you know, it's like the old biblical admonition. When there was no king in Israel, i.e. when God was not duly enthroned in the hearts of men, every man does what's right in his own eyes.
Yes. So. Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I'm just sitting here kind of thinking about you know, that we want to create. Man has this thing about creating situations for himself. Is that we need to think about new things. Well, it's either Proverbs or Ecclesiastes. I can't remember.
Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new.
Nothing
under
new
the
under the sun. Yeah, it's Ecclesiastes. There is nothing new under the sun.
Nope.
All these things have been done before. And all of them have failed eventually. They look like, sometimes things look like success when they're not. And there are people out there who really think, because I was born this way, they think, that therefore that means God made them that way. Well, folks, we're all born sinners. We all have desires and ideas and all kinds of things that we shouldn't do, and yet we do them. Adam and Eve ate the apple. They weren't allowed to do that. They did it. Cain killed Abel. Just because you have the desire to do something. There are all kinds of serial killers out there who have this drive to kill people.
Yes.
Well, it's right for them. It's what they wanted to do. It suits their needs. Shouldn't they be allowed to do that? And the answer is, well, no.
No, not really.
Now, you get into that argument about, well, no, because it harms another person. Okay. Now you get into the argument. Let's just for fun. There's an argument. For instance, I think in Germany, someone put an ad out that they wanted someone to kill them and eat them. And so someone answered this ad and, in fact, killed the person and ate them. And when the person who did the crime was caught, he wanted to argue that this was the will of both parties.
Yes.
Does that then make it wrong? Is it right that this person wanted to be killed and eaten, and the person that did the killing and eating did so? Who did it offend? Who was offended by that?
Well, God.
God was.
Yeah, it's like, okay, the only person that matters, God.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, with all due apologies to my wife and my kids, the only person who really matters, God.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why when you'll see cases of someone who's kidnapped but forgives their kidnapper and says, well, I don't really want you to prosecute that person. Do they normally go ahead and prosecute that? Well, in modern parlance, you would ask the prosecutor why. Well, because it's an offense and it's against the law whether the person wants to press charges or not. Who does the state represent in those cases? The state represents God.
It's supposed to be, yes.
Yes, because God is the offended party. Because kidnapping is a sin. And whether the person who was kidnapped decided to forgive and forget, it doesn't matter. Because God was offended. And therefore, the state has the right to wield the sword. And that is something that we've gotten away from in our society. That's why we can have these arguments. And again, that's why marriage can be restricted to people who are further away than second cousins. People who are diseased. People who are can be restricted to people who are of different sexes.
Right, exactly.
Because anything else is offensive to God. And that is something that we have very badly lost track of. So what do we do about that?
Well, first of all, we repent. Second of all, we try to repair the gates, and we try to restore the waste places, as Scripture tells us to do. And we can only do that if we understand God's Word, and then we understand our founding documents, the Constitution. So honestly, really, Chuck, other than people getting in their Bibles and going to church and, you know, coming clean before God that we've been wanting it our own way for too long, and He's giving it to us now, and we don't like it, and maybe we should be back on His way. Perhaps people should start like thinking about, okay, maybe I should understand a little bit more about this government that's over me and how they're supposed to operate, not how they are operating. And so I would suggest people check out our Institute on the Constitution courses. This fall, I think we've got courses starting at least in Delaware, and I believe possibly, and I'll know more tonight, in Circleville.
Okay.
In the fall, and we can start others in other locations. There are going to be in the western part of the state, southwestern part of the state, there are always classes going. But you know what? Call us. Let us know.
Yeah.
You know, if you can put together a dozen people in your group, whether it's your homeschool group or your church group or whatever, or, you know, if it's your Republican club, which is where we're going to, I think, in Delaware, we're willing to travel as long as you're willing to bring people who want to learn and who are open to looking at things from a biblical perspective instead of from the mess-we're-in perspective.
Visit our website at principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. If you're going to be in the Pliny, West Virginia area on Sunday, then you should visit Barry's church. Give them the The name?
Pliny Presbyterian, and you can't find it from here.
It's just off Route 35.
Yeah, it is.
In Pliny, West Virginia. And if you're in the Pataskala, Reynoldsburg, and Pickerington areas on Sunday, then we invite you to join us at Providence Presbyterian Church, 7035 Summit Road in Pataskala. In our brand new church, you'll be joining us for, I think, our fourth service. So that being said, we're out of time. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.